Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our two co-hosts today, Alan Phillips, attorney at law, and Greg Glazer, constitutional lawyer from California. Today is April 12, 2012. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and learning about your rights and your freedoms in America. And about today, we're going to go a little bit into the origins of health freedom, the history of our forefathers, maybe. we'll find out. Whatever Greg brings for us, I am willing to listen and looking forward to it. If you want to be part of this educational movement, just tell your friends to listen to the show, send them an email with a link, tweet it on Twitter like I do, post the share button on Facebook and reach many, many more people. Post it onto Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace, and all the other social networks. Copy the embed code of this show for your website and get lots of listeners to thank you for what you have provided for them to listen to. Favorite the show, become a regular listener, and click the reminder button. You can always contact me, Debbie Brock, at Homeopathy World Community. You can contact Greg Glazer, and he's going to tell us what the name of his website is. I know he's been working feverishly on developing a new site. That's www.civilactionnetwork.org. He is from Copperopolis?
Hi, California? Debbie.
Copperopolis. Yeah, it reminds me of Superman. And he is also the founder of the Civil Action Network, an independent media organization offering coordinated citizens referenda to promote justice, liberty, and sustainable living. We also have my favorite friend, Alan Phillips, from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys. He advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States all about vaccine exemptions and waiver rights. He supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice and is published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters. I wanted to mention also he is an author on Natural News with Mike Adams. We're so proud of him for all of the articles he has posted, for the white papers he has prepared, for the investigative work that he puts together, these articles and contacts people who are at the cutting edge of what's going on in the current vaccine news today. And his website is pandemicresponseproject.com. And I think we're ready to start in. I want to welcome both Greg and Alan to the show.
Good morning, Debbie. Hey, Greg.
Nice to be here. Hey, Alan.
That was a long intro, but, you know, you deserve it.
Thank you, Debbie.
So, today's topic is very interesting. It's going to be the origins of health freedom. And I wanted to actually start the topic off by kicking it back to you guys and asking what your thoughts are on what is the origin of health freedom.
Well, that's a good question. I would go back to the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, probably just because, you know, that's how our country got started. that not only religious freedom, freedom to think and practice and have a belief system, but they were looking for a place where they could have all of the freedoms that a human being deserves on this planet.
So health freedom begins at the time you enter a new land, the time you enter a new wilderness.
Okay, take it from there.
Yeah, and Alan, how about your thoughts? What do you think would be the origin of health freedom?
Well, I don't have a quick and clear answer for you. I know that historically here in the U.S., there's always been, as vaccines are concerned, there's always been this tension between what the balancing between personal freedom and then the obligation of the state to look out for the well-being of communities or for communities. And so I would imagine perhaps on a less formal level prior to current society and civilization that perhaps there were some similar or related ideas. It's an interesting concept because I think outside of vaccines, when you talk about health freedom and let's put infectious disease and vaccines on the side for a moment, it seems to be a fairly straightforward question, even if the answer is inherently complex, that individuals at some level, if not to a very extreme level, should have a right to decide healthcare for themselves and for their children. And I think probably most people would say, well, there's some point where the state should intervene with regard to children anyway. If a parent is clearly doing something that is risking or causing serious harm to a child, now where you draw the lines is a huge mess, and who gets to draw them and based on what criteria and so forth. But it always gets more complicated with the infectious disease arena, because then it's not purely, or arguably anyway, is not purely a, well, it's my body, my right kind of question, because then the issue comes up, or the question at least comes up, where does what I do with my body have effect on other people? And that's, of course, the whole thing about vaccines is supposedly if we don't get vaccinated, we're putting other people at risk. And, of course, we can debate that one hotly on both sides, I suppose. But I don't have information, you know, beyond those general concepts about the origins of health freedom. Does any of that tie into it, Greg?
It does. It does. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, I set out to answer this question, what is the origin of health freedom? And in researching it, I realized that it's not a question that can realistically be answered by a man in the 21st century. All I could do is just research it and come not with answers, but rather with some deductions that are kind of like some just providing a bunch of useful information. So what I did is I kind of categorized the information and found that the origins of health freedom lie in essentially four different aspects. And the first origin is philosophical and physical. And then the second would be in the legal sense of early tort law and criminal law. And then the next one, the third one, is biblical. And then the last one is with regard to property in the history of slavery. So I think I'll just touch on each one, and then as I'm going through them, just continually please do chime in and let me know your thoughts on these. So the first is our origin of health freedom is philosophical and physical. It's this idea that the definition of health and freedom really is integrated with the human body and the human experience. And so health freedom begins with the very first human. And it's this philosophical basis of it being inherent, and an inherent fundamental or inalienable right is something that cannot be separated from the human. So health freedom, if it is truly inherent, was born or existed with the first human, and has never and cannot be separated from the human without severing the human from his or her life. So cool. And then as we've evolved into societies from tribal entities into more of a community of we've had a the development of early tort law and criminal law. And so looking at cases And looking at historical, it appears that courts have found that the right of self-defense is integrated with the right of health freedom, this ability to defend yourself from any other person in a reasonable manner, and that you have the right to be free from anyone coming in and committing a battery against you. And so what scholars have found is that the real origin of health freedom has come up when it's been challenged. So although it was inherent, it was only tested in our modern societies when we had courts, and by modern I mean like post-tribal, when we had courts and there was some conflict that came into being. And so the as one court said, and this is recently, just to kind of sum up the history, it's upon the principle of self-defense, of paramount necessity, a community has the right to protect itself against an epidemic of disease which threatens the safety of its members. And so health freedom was a response in many ways to threats to the community from disease. And the right to refuse medical treatment, according to scholars, is based on the common law right to be free from battery. Battery is an offensive touching of the person, of the body. So that perhaps dovetails well into discussing the biblical origin of health freedom and what the consequence was for not following the biblical guidelines. And the Bible presents hygiene and quarantine laws. For example, the quarantine of lepers is mentioned in Leviticus 13. I think you guys will be interested to know that there's nothing in the Bible regarding vaccination.
Oh, darn. Not by name, anyway.
Right.
Because I will say, of course you would know this, Greg, but I've had many clients, and of course, statistically, as one would expect, a larger percentage of my clients are Christian than any other religion and here in the U.S. And I have been quite surprised over time, every time I thought that I had really, at this point, I've seen really every passage from the Bible that someone's going to show me that they interpret, and there's always interpretation because, as you know, your point being the vaccine specifically are not addressed, but that they interpret to mean that they can't or shouldn't vaccinate. The next client comes along and shows me a couple more passages. So I've just been really intrigued at how many, and there are many, many passages in the Bible that at least some people see as saying that they can't or shouldn't vaccinate. But it's potentially, I suppose the Bible's open for interpretation, you know, more or less on any topic, but it's particularly, I think, open for interpretation when you're dealing with something like vaccines that is not specifically named in the Bible. And so then people look to see, to try to understand what the Bible means or says with regard to the issue. I think it's an interesting and perhaps challenging question at times.
Yeah.
I agree with Alan. I think biblical roots to answering this problem for individuals, the Bible and its commentaries have many, many different interpretations. So I am looking forward to hearing what you say in terms of the quarantine issue, because from the rabbis that I have spoken to, it probably has a different interpretation than what you're going to say.
Let's throw it back and forth and see what we come up with here.
Okay.
Sure. Well, you know, the doctors of the Jewish people, historically, of the Israelites, are among, if not the most respected in history, because of the Israelites being so advanced in their hygiene laws and in their ability to maintain the health of the populace. And this is because of very stringent rules regarding what meats were classified as being safe. And in particular, with hygiene laws, just washing your hands after procedures. You know, we look even into the 1800s of doctors who would go examine corpses in the morning and then go perform
surgery,
birthing, procedures
or birthing
with washing their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some doctors would try to, you know, put an end to this practice. And is one guy put an end to the practice of who made sure that all doctors washed their hands. He was eventually fired from his job, and then he had to go. You know, he moved to another country to find new work, and then, you know, as this all happened, mortality rates spike. You know, following him leaving in the wake, it was just this kind of like death of ancient medicine.
Mm-hmm. We're losing the sound today. And your sound is fading out. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, the vestige of uneducated populations have flowed well into modern medicine.
Well, and sanitation knowledge was not really understood or used or practiced. And today we've kind of gone the opposite way. We're on the, you know, everybody is using an antibacterial soap to wash their hands, and now what we're doing is creating superbugs. So there is a happy medium to taking, you know, protection, like you were saying at the beginning. We have a right to self-defense, and we should take a modicum of precautions with sanitation. But then again, if you go overboard in any direction, we're mostly composed of bugs. If you didn't realize that, when we get born, we are covered with bacteria, but that populate us, and we do need to live in harmony and symbiosis with our environment. So we need all of that to keep alive and functioning well. But again, we need to know what is the right kind of bugs. And so kind of getting off into this health field, but it's true that the practices of the day were not good for a healthy environment and keeping humans healthy. Now I got totally off topic. So tell me where we were again.
Oh no, I thought that was very much on topic. Talking about the biblical rules and how that ties into the origins of health freedom. And you know, just to take an example, as you brought up the example of antibacterial soap today, in the biblical times, according to Psalms and Leviticus, one of the remedies for bacteria when washing your hands would have been hyssop, which is an herb I'm actually growing in my garden. And hyssop has the property of penicillin. And you know, another remedy from Leviticus would be scarlet, cedarwood. You know, what the commandments were about back then was being in harmony with nature and your community. I suppose striking the balance. So there were rules. There were these community rules, but they were natural. And when we look back on them, some seem to be very, very brutish. In fact, like for example, one rule that we might just take a look at would be the rule of circumcision on the eighth day of life. But as it turns out, modern science has shown us that there is a particular blood clotting mechanism that is at its height on the eighth day of a newborn baby's life. That And
how would they know that, really? How would they know that information? The people really would not know what I would say God is making aware for us today, giving us this knowledge about the intricacies of the body's function. But it was really, truly only to make us adhere a little bit more and have meaning and understanding. But in essence, any rabbi would tell you that all of the laws in Leviticus and throughout the Bible are given for spiritual purification, for a real, we don't really know and understand. And in God's unlimited power and omnipotence, that he's just giving us little tastes of information that we really, just to make us, please us. That's what I have studied and learned in Kabbalah. So When you say there are quarantines and things like that, and in Leviticus they talked about skin disease, these were really in the time of the giving of the Bible, the five commandments, the Torah, were spiritual illness. The origin was a spiritual imbalance. People were not in community. They were speaking in gossip, and this is the origin of all of these illnesses. And
well, we find people speaking in from a metaphysical perspective today saying the same thing. You know, the clairvoyants notice that illness shows up in the aura before it shows up in the physical body. I mean, even physical illness is, by some people's observations, something that has a spiritual origin, or at minimum, even a physical accident has a spiritual component. It sort of depends on how you define the terms and so forth. So I'm not sure that they're separate things necessarily. They may be in any case. It's real interesting because that all ties into a comment I was thinking about here as I was listening to both of you talk. The rules are always going to be relative to the understanding and belief of the people involved. Whether that is something that is correct by some other person's frame of reference or perspective or insight is perhaps something altogether a separate question. But I don't know if this is an aspect of our current culture and society, or perhaps human beings in a broader sense. But there's a real kind of, and particularly in the medical profession currently, there's a real arrogance, and I would broaden it. I would say the scientific community generally, there's a real arrogance of this kind of unspoken, we have arrived, now we know everything. And we seem to not recognize that knowledge is boundless, and that learning is something that has gone on and will continue to go on indefinitely. And that any place that we are in terms of our understanding and our rules about health or anything else for that matter, again, being a reflection of our current understanding. And we can look back to the 1800s and say the doctors didn't understand about bacterial infection and that washing their hands could save lives and so forth. They might be able to have noticed that as an observation, but they might not have had the level of science to understand that. But just understanding that germs cause disease doesn't mean that you need to get rid of every germ, as Debbie was saying. You know, we were born covered with bacteria. That's not necessarily wrong or bad. And so our learning and understanding evolves. But what I think goes on, and I'd love to hear your comments about this, Greg, if you've seen this in looking at healthcare and health freedom historically, that I can look back on what happened in the 1800s with doctors not washing their hands as a very unfortunate occurrence in terms of the consequences. But nonetheless, I can see that in large part as being about ignorance, about what they were doing or not doing. I'm sure it was not something intentionally done to cause the harm that nevertheless resulted. But there, once you are in a position where you recognize that information or lack of it controls outcomes, you are potentially in a position to decide to do that in a more, to control information to create a particular outcome. I think there's probably been a lot of avoidable harm out of ignorance. But I fear that we're seeing something on a different level, increasingly so in recent decades and years here in the U.S. and perhaps around the world, where there are people who know that harm is resulting, but they're deliberately withholding or in other ways controlling the information, either to cause the harm or at the very best allowing the harm because there's profit or something else beneficial coming out of that. Have you seen any indication, Greg, historically that the kind of corruption that I assert, and I think you and I at least generally agree on this, that exists today in the healthcare arena that causes avoidable harm? And it's not just a question of the current state of medical science doesn't allow us to know things, and therefore people are dying needlessly, while surely that happens in some level in some cases. There's a whole different.
I'm going to throw out one word or three words: Noah and the Ark. I think that was a time when definitely there was that level of corruption.
Oh well, it's not that I think corruption never existed and now it does,
I'm wondering about
in the healthcare arena. Do we see evidence historically of deception, either deliberately to cause or knowing, you know, other than perhaps that what just pops into mind as an example is when the some of the colonists gave smallpox-infected blankets to the Indians, knowing that the Indians would then catch smallpox. You know, that was an example of a deliberate deception in a limited way. But have you seen? It's not that I think human beings are any different now than they have been in that regard generally. I'm just wondering if you see evidence of that historically in the healthcare arena in particular.
Oh boy, do I have mounting evidence. And you know, the points that you guys just raised are so compelling. You know, I just wanted to say that. And you know, it's a phenomenally interesting topic. To start with, regarding the
I started it off good, Greg. Valid. I started it off right with the colonialists escaping to go to a land of freedom to practice religion, and you end up talking about the biblical laws. It's very interesting how it circles around that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, the to give one example of the of oppression in history, we don't even have to look too far. New York City, 1916. They would take children who had been diagnosed with polio. They'd take them from their parents, and they would, it was a form of quarantine. And wealthier families remained intact because they could, you know, hire nurses and lawyers essentially to fight the tyranny. And this sort of thing goes so far back. You know, we look at European and Asian countries. They were among some of the first to experiment with quarantines. I've talked about Italy too, and they would guards were permitted to murder anyone who was fleeing or spreading a contagion or like fleeing a quarantine. And another response, like Milan, for example, they would force those suffering from a plague to go into the forest and would have to stay there where they were quote purified by wind for a month. And we look at other examples of total ignorance would be one where it was thought that disease was carried by smell. And so doctors would come in and put perfume on the ground and light it on fire to try to stop the smell from carrying on. It actually ended up helping the bacteria, but it was the flames that helped, not the the perfume odor. Now, looking back to the United States Constitution, there is no right of health freedom that is specifically stated explicitly in the Constitution. Now, there was one of the signers of the Constitution, a guy named Benjamin Rush. He was a doctor, a surgeon, actually, at the helping the Continental Armies. And he asked for one. He said that, quote, "Unless we put medical freedom into the Constitution, the time will come when medicine will organize into an undercover dictatorship to restrict the art of healing to one class of men and deny equal privileges to others. The Constitution of the Republic should make a special privilege for medical freedoms as well as religious freedom," close quote. So I thought that was particularly a useful quote to show that, you know, these issues were available at the time, and it helps emphasize Alan's point that today, you know, this sort of prediction or this prediction by Benjamin Rush has really come to fruition. We've seen the medical dictatorship. And now going back to Debbie's comment about Noah and the Ark in those ancient days, you know, the original word for sorcery, I think it's called a pharmacopoeia, which is our modern pharmacy. It's this idea of sorcery, the idea of the spiritual taking precedence over the physical. Now that, so when we look at the spiritual roots of at our being cleansed in spirit before being cleansed physically, we see that, or I see that our physical world is like evidence for what is happening in the spiritual world. That the The physical world is, we can almost see it as this sort of three-dimensional shadow of this greater dimensional spiritual source. And I think that's very helpful on a from a philosophical level. Now, where the law in particular picks this up is only in what we lawyers call dicta. It means that when a case is brought before a court, the court is allowed to go at great length to talk about history and to talk about its reasoning, but its historical analysis and its reasoning are often just called dicta. It means that it's not binding on the public. It's not binding on other courts. It's just part of the rationale for the reason. Now, compare the holding. Now, the holding in the case is the ultimate conclusion that the court draws. It says, now, this is our interpretation of the law that we do want to be binding on, not just the parties to the case, but also binding upon future courts through the principle of stare decisis. So when we look, so when I look at old cases and try to find, you know, what is the underlying basis of the right to bodily integrity, and is there a recognition of a of spirituality in courts, and it's very difficult to find it. We find much more for bodily integrity than we do for any sort of spiritual right of freedom.
That's very difficult to deal with in America as we separate church and state, and therefore how do we integrate the fact that really in essence, like you say, so like above, so below, everything does start from the top down. And in America, if that is still true and we try to separate state and church, then it's really hard because there's really an impossibility there. If we're founded on religious freedom, then somehow it's got to seep in, and it really needs to seep in because there is a higher authority, and that provides us our freedom. That's what it's about.
Yeah, you know, there's a question right now in the chat.
Oh, good. I'm glad you're viewing.
Yeah, it's that, you know, and the question is it's a theoretical question, and it's this has also been asked in law reviews as well. It's do you kill, or does the government kill 1,000 people to heal 1,000,000? It's not an easy question in modern medicine, and I think that the answer to that question that I've seen is that when the way that question is often posed by commentators and scholars is that it's used to justify public health laws. You say that it is better to infringe the rights of few in order to protect the masses, and this was enshrined in the Jacobson versus Massachusetts case, where the court said, "Gosh, I need an assistant to pull up these things on cue." court said, "I'm going to try to. You know what? I'm going to try to pull up that quote later."
Essentially, what the court said was that there's not an unlimited right to bodily integrity, I guess. It was sort of the message there that where the individual's rights end is where the state has a need to look out for the community.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that liberty is limited. Quote: there are manifold restraints to which every person is necessarily subject for the common good. Close quote. That was the quote I was looking for, and. So, in that context, we find that this right of bodily integrity is recognized, but it's also limited, and so it's constantly in flux. And so, getting back to the question that's in the chat, which is, do you kill 1,000 people to heal 1,000,000? My response would be that we don't have to do either. That by letting people enjoy the benefits of the right to bodily integrity and encouraging them to engage in the use of natural remedies, nobody needs to be like, you know, forcibly vaccinated where science can prove that, you know, so many people are going to contract the disease being vaccinated against, so many people are going to go, you know, suffer paralysis, blindness, death, you know, autism, and so forth. So I
of course,
would consider,
the, the, the question, of course, that this brings up is, because I'll tell you, Greg, I don't have a problem with the basic concept of sacrifice a few for the many, but I have a tremendous problem with the idea of somebody else getting to decide for me how they're going to define the terms or determine when, in fact, that's the situation. We've got a wonderful example going on right now in Vermont. There's a bill to remove the philosophical exemption, and both the state Senate and the House have gone through variations of amendments to the bill and wording it in different ways where they might keep it but put other barriers that don't currently exist to the exercise of the exemption. But I saw someone sent an email as part of that debate pointing out that, well, you know, according to VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which, by the way, is not a determination of fact as to whether or not a vaccine caused a death or disability. It's merely a reporting system of suspected. But based on VAERS data, that someone was saying there have been 3 deaths in Vermont from vaccines, I think in the last year, there were no deaths from infectious disease. And it really takes that idea of we have to vaccinate because even though vaccines cause harm, because that's, you know, a small price to pay for not having, you know, infectious diseases and so forth. As soon as you say that we're going to subscribe, we as a society say that we're going to subscribe to that principle that, yes, we're going to allow the sacrifice of a few to save the many, it's even if it's a fundamentally good concept on an abstract level, the implementation of it is riddled with complexities. We know, for example, that even the CDC and FDA tell us that 90 to 99% of vaccine adverse events aren't reported, and other medical authorities have said made similar claims. And there just isn't data available to calculate, and yet the authorities keep pushing this same theory on us that, yes, vaccines hurt a few people, but not nearly as many as the diseases would. And yet, you know, 90 to 95% of disease decline for the childhood infectious diseases preceded the vaccine. So it gets immediately, in this arena anyway, politically complex, factually, scientifically, and politically complex, because we end up in a debate about whether or not that's actually what we're doing, which makes me wonder, given, therefore, who we are as a society and perhaps even who we are as human beings on a more fundamental level, even if that concept is valid, if there were in a situation where we're absolutely clear that 10 people would die but 100 people would live because the 10 people died, I could easily see a lot of people saying, well, I don't want to be in that situation to have to make that decision in the first place. But if it were absolutely clear that's what was going on, I could make the utilitarian decision to say, kill the 10 to save the 100. But
it's a very ethical and moral question, which is debated in every religious class, hopefully, that, you know, who is to say who is going to raise the hand to kill the next one? And you don't know who it is that you are potentially killing.
What I'm saying is, even if we, and I'm not saying that I agree with the utilitarian position, but I'm saying that even if we do agree that where it's crystal clear that's the appropriate way to deal with a situation, how many times in the real world is it ever going to be crystal clear? And it certainly is anything
never.
But clear in the vaccine arena. And if it's true
you,
that it would never be
give
clear,
you very
then let's...
compelling evidence that the implementation of that would be carried out horribly. You know, people have tried to sue to prevent fluoridation of water. And anyone who's researched fluoridation of water honestly knows that fluoridation is terrible. It harms your health and makes you more docile. And one court in California found that courts throughout the United States have uniformly held that fluoridation of water is a reasonable and proper exercise of the police power in the interest of the public health, just tossing out lawsuits. And then that court later goes on to say that neither the state nor federal constitution guarantees a right to a healthful or contaminant-free environment. And so it's this idea that the modern culture of America, including the courts, has already accepted the compromise to health and have enshrined it in the standard of living, which is really more of the tolerable standard of dying, and this sort of tolerable standard of pollution and crime, and we call it a standard of living, but it's a tolerable standard of crime and pollution. And
accepting poor sanitation, poor living quality, poor, you know, what's the criminal activity that's going on, all of the negative things in the world, accepting that, I'm going back to Noah. So what does a person do?
Yeah, I wanted to hear you flesh that out more, because I'm so interested in that. So in the book of Genesis, chapter 6, describes that during this time of Noah, the sons of men, the daughters of men had known the sons of who? And it was like the Nephilim, and that there was a corruption, including corruption of the seed. It suggests some type of genetic corruption as well as something more, something spiritual, and that the cause and that all of this corruption angered the creator of earth, and then the creator flooded the earth in order to purify the ones who were chosen. The ones who were chosen were Noah and Noah's, I think it's four or six sons, and their wives.
Mm-hmm. I am not, you know, I'm not going to be able to rattle off details. I didn't prepare any of this information. It just came into my mind as you questioned at the beginning. But Noah spent many, many hundreds of years building that ark for people to look at and see, what is this crazy man doing? Meanwhile, everyone else was going through all of these very horrible behaviors. In order to eat, they would take an animal and cut off a leg, cut off a limb, cut off a piece, and let the animal run around, just so that they would still have, you know, because they didn't have preservatives, they didn't have a freezer or a fridge, and they would do these horrendous kind of criminal acts to animals and human beings. There was a lot of, you know, all of the negative things that you think about, jealousy, and harming the neighbor, and doing all of these things, and willfully, while Noah was trying to keep within the law of what he found, and ending up that nobody took heed of his warnings, and therefore God wiped out the earth as we knew it at that time, and saved two of everything and Noah's family, and to start again, to kind of start fresh. And of course the rainbow was there to say God would never do such a thing again, although I'm sure we've tempted him quite a bit lately to go ahead and do it again. He's given us the power of nuclear war and nuclear meltdowns, and we're kind of killing ourselves with radiation. Besides all of that, yes, this is what was going on, what I say as very poor behavior and thinking and acting and speaking. And this is why I'm saying it goes back to religion and fundamentally the golden rule of being good to thy neighbor. Did you need there's a website. There's plenty of websites where people can learn about the seven Noahide laws, because Jewish people are obligated to keep the Ten Commandments and 316 commandments. But everybody else does not have to abide by any of that. They have to abide by just the seven Noahide laws as if they wish to conform to that. Has that been helpful?
Yes. Yeah. And those Noahide laws, would you like to go into them?
Do I want to go into them? Hold on a second. I did give a link to them on the chat for those folks who are there. Let me see if they have them listed. Let me see. I don't have them listed right away. I'd have to do another little search to find them. There's also, let's see what page might have them. There's the Learning Center here. Maybe it has it there. People can always search for it themselves. It says God.
Among the seven Noahide laws that relate to the right of bodily integrity and health freedom, you have the prohibition on sexual immorality, and then you have the prohibition of eating flesh taken from an mole while it is still alive. And so the that sixth one is the one that you were discussing in particular, where you had this it was what it was bad behavior. And
well, you're not supposed to speak against, you know, speak behind another person. You're not supposed to gossip. That's a really big thing. It says there's a prohibition against theft, including kidnapping. God, we know this is a rampant in this world today. Cheating, yes. Cheating an employee, cheating an employer, and a variety of similar acts. Prohibition against illicit sexuality includes six particular prohibitions, and it's derived from the verse, Noahides are prohibited from engaging in six illicit sexual relationships with one's mother, with one's father's wife, with another man's wife, with his sister from the same mother, in a male homosexual union, and with an animal, as it says, quote, therefore shall a man leave his father, unquote. This refers to his father's wife, quote, and his mother refers to his mother, and on and on. So this is, you said the Israelite or the Jewish physicians were highly regarded, and Maimonides was one of the main physicians of the time that put down many, many regulations to and understandings of health and sanitation and how to take care of others.
Yeah, well, you know, the world receives its blessings through Israel.
Well,
and
more people should learn.
Yeah, and so these Noahide laws, they're discussing things that are in many ways very uncomfortable for us to talk about, especially on those sexual rules. And so it is a lesson as we, you know, as 21st century humans today, it's a lesson for us to also be able to make laws around some of the things that are uncomfortable for us to talk about today. And I think, you know, one of the first and foremost things is all of these conspiracies, and this great new sorcery, the new pharmacopoeia, which has presented drugs and surgery, pharmaceutical drugs and conventional surgery, as the answer to all of your ailments. And I think as we find, you know, looking back at historical societies, it wasn't enough to just be organic and natural, because back then everything was. It was what Debbie was describing earlier. It's that this golden rule, treat others as you would like to be treated, is essential to an honest approach to naturalism. And then when we combine the two, then, you know, you're looking at a society of ideally benevolent and environmentally conscious actors. And it's in that society when it becomes easier to pull the weeds, regulate the weeds of those who are attempting to corrupt it. But when you have systemic problems like we have today in the medical industry.
Oh, we lost your sound. Can we hear you? Okay, he's totally gone. He may have to sign in again if we've lost his sound. Yes, he has. His internet has dropped. Alan, are you there?
I am.
Okay, well, it's you and me until he can get back his internet connection, because he lost his connection. So I don't know whether you're familiar with the Noahide laws or the origin, but it is one way of seeing a foundation for good behavior toward your fellow man.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, and maybe to take it back to a comment you had made earlier in the show, then, that you were saying that they were seeing this, you know, a lot of this, we're looking, of course, at the health perspective of this, they weren't maybe so much seeing this as health laws as they were spiritual laws, and maybe not recognizing the on a health level, or at least not focused on that as a benefit from what they were doing. Am I
That's a fascinating perspective. That is a fascinating perspective, because the laws were given after the Exodus, when we're talking about, actually, this is the week of Passover, but previously the Noahide laws were given after the period of Noah, way before the Exodus, and I guess, you know, it's sort of like a wake-up call to humanity. Take a double take and see what is your role and responsibility in caring for yourself and others. And in other words, these are the beginnings of what we would say has integrated into constitutional law. I would think that these laws are there for us to guide us and help us to be better humans in the world. With all the stuff that's going around today, and I was fascinated, he called it sorcery. And you think of the witch hunts that are done, and I think maybe he's been able to get back in. Now, hi, we lost your internet connection.
Hey, guys. Sorry about
that. Do you remember where you were talking about sorcery?
I was talking about modern pharmacopoeia and how I gave the analogy of if you've ever planted a large garden and then let it grow with weeds for a long time and then you go out and try to weed it, you'll end up having bloody hands at the end of it because it is so there's just so much work. And it makes me think of Noah at the time of just being surrounded by such a perverted culture, you might say, and not just sexually, I'm talking about like perverting values. And I find that analogous to today. We're just saturated with rhetoric and self-indulgence and self-righteousness. And there are, I mean, how many Noahs are there among us? I don't know. And I certainly wouldn't claim to be one.
People calling out that warning like a prophet, to say, take heed, this is what your future is going to be if you don't change your ways, basically.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that there are plenty of people out there who are doing that, but not everybody is listening. And we have the problem of a lot of noise, the noise of the mainstream media that's giving their message over top of the other people who are trying to eke out their space, and say, well, fluoridation really isn't good and x-rays aren't good and all of these other things. And why? But I think that slowly it's turning around. And because we have been swayed so much by this evidence-based culture, that we're having to use our own eyes and ears as our personal evidence.
And thank goodness for the internet. That's
thank
really
goodness.
Helped. it allows us not just access to information on demand, but the ability to communicate with others and then express our vote. We're rocking the vote by our and anytime that you express a comment on the internet or vote for something or like something, it's a new way to kind of get a pulse on the populace. So we're not as beholden to the mass media, but all the same, when you surf the internet and look at what's mainstream, you recognize that society is beholden. It's these bonds that are so hard to break. And it might be a nice segue to discussing the fourth item for our origin of health freedom. That health freedom, one of the ways that we know how much health freedom we have is by when it's taken away. And traditionally, one of the defining differences between slavery and other domestic relations was precisely that it was the body of the slave that was subject to the master's, quote, uncontrolled authority. And that quote comes from a Supreme Court case of Ingraham versus Wright, 1977, if anyone's interested in that. And so the body was the focus of the right to medical integrity. And so looking at other cases from the Supreme Court, we find that there is this right of bodily integrity, but it is sort of limited to instances where the intrusion is incredibly significant, like forced medical treatment would be an example of one. But as I mentioned in that California case, that recent California case about water fluoridation, the court there found that poisoning the public water, and I use the word poisoning, treating the water supply with fluoride did not infringe upon this man's right. They said, we're going to toss your case. We're not even going to hear you. because you can't claim that treating the public water supply arises to a violation of one of your fundamental rights.
So, let me chime in real quick, if I may, on this, because this is a point that, or it raises a point that I am making frequently with clients in the vaccine exemption and waiver arena. And I tell people that in the case of vaccines, since they've been licensed by the FDA and they've been mandated by the state legislature or in the case of military or immigration by federal agencies, there's actually a legal presumption that vaccines are safe and effective and necessary, or else they would not have been mandated and they would not have gotten wouldn't have gotten through the licensing procedure if they weren't safe. And what I say to my clients when I discuss this idea about legal presumptions is not that I'm saying that I personally agree with that. What I'm saying is that the place to take our opposition to that in the case of exemptions and waivers is not in the exercise of an exemption and waiver. The place to take that argument is back to the state legislature. So if there's a state or local law that is mandating fluoridation, one could argue as a matter of legal analysis, as opposed and separate from scientific fact, that there's a legal presumption that it is safe or it wouldn't be mandated. And this tie goes into another thing that I think came up in the Jacobson case, and this idea that, and this is very confusing for lay people and probably attorneys as well at times, is that courts, their fundamental role really doesn't include deciding science. They weigh the evidence, and if you have experts, the quote-unquote experts who are saying whatever it is that they're saying, they can be, you know, scientifically ultimately as wrong as whatever, could be totally off base, but if that's their opinion, then the weight of their evidence is going to be high. It's going to be strong in court, even if it's ultimately wrong. And the Jacobson case said some very disturbing things to the effect of, if the majority, it's not up to us to decide the truth here, if the majority of doctors and the majority of the public think that vaccines are okay, then they're okay. And again, that's disturbing, if for no other reason, that it, what it implies, at least in modern times, is he who controls the media controls the law. And it's maybe there's an appropriateness to the idea that courts aren't deciding the science, they're weighing the evidence, and they let the legislature is supposed to do all of that research, and then if the legislature comes up with an answer, the courts have to presume that that's a good answer. It doesn't really leave us with a check and balance to the legislature to put that restriction on courts. But do you have any thoughts or comments about these ideas of legal presumption? And from my point of view, on a practical level, it's about where to take our arguments.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, you raise a really subtle but important point that, you know, the Jacobson case was decided in the context of due process, and there's substantive due process and procedural due process. And when the court analyzes the procedural due process, they say, we courts aren't going to decide this issue. We're going to leave it to the experts to decide this issue. So, as you know, so Americans, as you go forward, and, you know, health boards, as you go forward, we want you to make sure just that you are giving, you know, a right to a fair hearing, fair notice, make sure that you have medical experts on board. And if you take all those steps, then whatever decision you come to, we courts will respect your decision. But we're not going to come in and insert our own medical judgment in individual cases. And that's why, perhaps, you have only one case, Jacobson versus Massachusetts, that decides this in 1905, and then no other cases come up because they put it to rest once and for all on that level. And so what we do, what we scholars do, is we go back and we look at Jacobson and say, okay, if it was put to rest, what exactly was put to rest? What does this case really mean? And I've said before that Jacobson is sort of the tale of two cases. It's one part of the case just has the most lofty language about your right to bodily integrity, and there's something that's so inviolable within you that no government can touch. And then on the other hand, the case is also saying that, you know, you could be forced against your will to submit to certain things, like, and the court gave the example of the military draft. So it's up to us Now it's up to the public to give meaning to this ruling, and that's what I think the court intentionally wanted to do, just give it back to the people and say, okay, we want you to be smart about your governance. And that's really how it was traditionally defined. Actually, that's one of my complaints about scholars today, is that often scholars don't give enough credence to the meaning and history of a republic, of hierarchical government. It's because fundamental rights are protected and recognized first at the local level, not at the federal level. And so I find that, you know, I read a lot of law review articles, and scholars often only begin looking at history whenever the Supreme Court says something is relevant in history. It's like the Supreme Court gets to define what is relevant in our world, but they're not looking at these lower court cases, not looking at actual history at the state and local level. It's just because it's easy, it's convenient. You know, we're all busy to just look at what the feds are doing rather than actually look at, you know, the details of state law. And so, like, what's an example I could give? Okay, here's a law review from Ben Horowitz about Jacobson versus Massachusetts, and he says, quote, because the enhanced protection of fundamental rights and the expansion of liberty and privacy rights did not occur until the latter half of the 20th century, the right to refuse medical treatment is relatively new, close quote. Now, that's just false, you know? The right to refuse medical treatment goes back to the tribal days, and yet this man is only looking at modern history because that's what the Supreme Court told him, and he just interpreted it incorrectly. So it is something where we can't rely on scholars to set the precedence here, and that, you know, we've gone through it in our show. We've gone through this a lot where, you know, this is in many ways untested ground. Scholars have come to different conclusions, and so it's just a matter of whether you want to put your trust and respect with naturopathic, with a naturopathic approach, or whether you want to put your trust in the military-industrial pharmaceutical complex to protect your rights, because the latter's not going to do it. They're just going to continue taking advantage and propagating this new world order.
Well, this has been – did you cover all of the points that you had that you wanted to make in regard – to this issue today about the origins of health freedom, or do we want to continue more with, it sounds like you've got some more material court cases or commentary on these court cases.
I do, yeah. Sometimes I have more research than I can realistically share.
Well, that's okay. We would like to hear it in an upcoming show. I want to let Alan take off. I know that he has an appointment to go to. So we're going to say thank you to Alan, and we will be in touch with you next Thursday at noon. Or let's see, next Thursday is the 19th.
Yep. We'll have a guest co-host because Debbie won't be with us next week. Rich Roberts, who manager of the Pandemic Response Project, will be filling in for you next week. Debbie, I'm happy to confirm that for you. Have been in touch with Rich recently.
Wonderful. Do you have a topic?
We will be looking at, we'll be doing the legislative update and, of course, looking at some of the latest news items, which keep coming up on a daily, virtually, if not literally, daily basis. So we'll be following current vaccine related news and legislative update. There's stuff going on all over the country, so we'll try to keep tabs on some of the more important parts of that. Greg, fascinating as always. You are a researcher extraordinaire. It's always just great to have you on. I always learn so much. I'm looking forward to having you back soon. I'll let you two finish it off, and I will take off, and look forward to seeing you again real soon, Greg. And Debbie, I guess in a couple of weeks, but...
Yeah, but
next week, though.
Yes, I want to let you know you might be interested, Alan. You might tell some friends on Monday on the brand new Health In live video stream show. We're going to have, in honor of World Homeopathy Awareness Week, we're going to have a special participatory game, and it's going to be called What Would Hahnemann Do? And we're going to have questions about the medical practices of today and ask our listeners to call in with answers to those questions.
Sounds great, Deb.
Okay, well, enjoy your rest of your day.
Thank you. Same to you, too.
Thank you. So, Greg, this has been an incredible show today. I have thoroughly enjoyed learning with you. And perhaps you'll tell us if you think that we should continue with the same line of thought and investigation into the origins of health freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we could make a whole another show out of this easily.
Okay. And I have another proposal for another idea. I have been reading, and maybe you can get some background information about brand new, or it's been out there, technology, and I'll send you an article all about the facial recognition equipment or application, so that let's say you are going into the airport and they will automatically know who you are and your background basically based on that. And even to the point of when you open up your own personal computer, your computer will recognize your face so that if you have privacy issues that no one else can open pages because they'll know who it is. And it's almost like James Bond of the eye scan, you know, when you saw the Goldfinger or whatever movies it was. Today, this is real. And it seems to be proposes many issues of privacy rights, like wherever you're walking, they'll know who you are and be able to keep tabs on you. So I would love to learn about that if you have information.
I do, yeah, and I'll put together a structure that we can talk about for that.
Sounds good. So I want to thank you for taking your time to be on with us on the Vaccinations and Your Rights show on Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community. Is there anything that you want to tell the folks about what you're presently doing and any initiatives or what they can get involved with?
Yeah, sure. I'd invite anyone interested in proposing change to go to civilactionnetwork.org, and you can vote on a referenda to reboot the American empire, as I have proposed, rewritten the Constitution, rewritten the several other codes, because this path is unsustainable that America is currently on, and I'd like to reboot it. And so you can vote for my proposal, vote for or against it, or write your own.
Well, and that reboot goes hand in hand with Noah.
It sure really does, Debbie.
Yeah, it does.
And I'm really glad that you brought that up. I thought that was key.
Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. So they can go to and just give the name of your is it www.civilactionnetwork.org?
That's it.
Okay, and there's plenty to learn about there. And so I want to thank you for being on. I will conclude the show if you want to take off now. I wanted to just let folks know about what else is coming up.
All right. Thanks so much, Debbie.
Thank you. Bye-bye. So if anybody else is still listening with us, we've had an incredible show at 11 a.m. today with Dr. Christina Chambrow, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, talking about vaccinations, especially the rabies vaccine and all the issues involved with that regarding your pets, the ones that you love, your cats, your dogs, your horses, and what is feasible, what you can do, and what kind of health reactions you could expect, whether acutely or chronically, for your animals. And we're going to also have a handout with that. If you go to homeopathyworldcommunity.com, there will be a place you can go to the group that I have listed, the 24 different shows that Christina has provided, so that you can learn about how to journal the condition of your animal and keep tabs on how well they are, or when you see any signs of illness, how you keep a diary and what to do about that. She has covered so much, I call them lessons for keeping your pets healthy. On Monday, we're having two shows, which I mentioned, the 11 a.m. Eastern Time USA. We will have the live video show, and this is going to be the third one in the series. And we're going to celebrate Hahnemann and World Homeopathy Awareness Week with this interactive 1-hour show. There's a place that you can go in and be on the chat, on the comment line. You can also call into the number and answer the questions that we're going to have. Elizabeth Brandegee will be talking a little bit about an introduction to what is World Homeopathy Awareness Week. In the evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Grant Bentley, he really gave a powerful talk last Monday evening. And Greg, you would love this one too. It was about nature, about how we respond in our own immune system to what is us and what is outside of us, how we defend ourselves, our own immune system, and how homeopathy works. And so he's going to continue on teaching, and I believe he'll tell us in the future when he's going to be visiting America so people can join his talk and his lecture live. On Wednesday morning, we have Dr. Adil Chimpalawala Kasim from India. He's been busy teaching classes and will be back April 25th talking about heart health. And that goes for everything. Our heart is our seat, our love center, our health center. And he talks about nutrition and exercise and diseases of the heart, diabetes, and everything to do with it. Bring your questions because he will answer them. He has great answers. He amazes me talking about energy medicine too, and yoga and breathwork, Reiki, and all the other things you can do to keep your heart healthy. I think that I've covered all of our shows Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and I'm wishing everyone a good end of the week and weekend. So we're going to close today's show, and once I find the music to sign us out, listen to Alan. He is an incredible musician, composer, and lyricist. Here he is singing.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Let your truth be young girl. One.